Peter Stone.
I'm Peter.
And I'm Felice.
Welcome to our travel podcast. We're specialist travel writers, and we've spent half a lifetime exploring every corner of the world.
So we want to share with you some of our extraordinary experiences and the amazing people we've met along the way. This week we're taking a look at adventure sailing for beginners. The majority of European first-timers head for Mediterranean flotilla holidays, where they spend a week learning the ropes before joining a convoy of small yachts to go island hopping, either around Greece or the Balearics.
But we're going in at the deep end, on much larger ocean-going vessels that can venture as far north as the Arctic Circle, where they can explore a world of polar bears and icebergs. Or you can go across the Atlantic to forgotten corners of the Caribbean. You need the right spirit, but absolutely no previous seafaring experience is necessary. So we met up with career adventurer Bruce Jacobs, who owns sailing holidays operator Rubicon 3. Bruce Jacobs, it's really good to have you on the show today. Where are you at the moment?
I'm in Portsmouth on the south coast of England.
Okay, so that's not the big sailing adventure that we're talking about today. That's where it all starts from, is it?
Yeah, that's where we're based from. So we run these large kind of round the world expedition sailing yachts. And there's actually only so many places that you can be based with that type of yacht, because you need enough of the heavy lift and the heavy industry to be able to service the yacht. So really, there's three places in England: Falmouth, Portsmouth and Glasgow in the UK, where you can base these yachts. So we're quite limited.
So they're big yachts, are they?
Yeah, they're each 18 metres, so 60-foot yachts. They're the first generation of the Clipper round the world race yachts, which began back in 1996. So they're really kind of like high-powered cruising yachts, I would say. Really solidly built, ocean-going yachts designed to withstand anything, really. So they're ideal for the types of trips that we run.
How many do you have?
We have four now, which is quite enough. We'd obviously like more as well, but it's each one, I think, is like a mini universe in itself, or like a remote house, and trying to maintain and run and look after each one of those when they're only with us in total for maybe 8 or 9 weeks of the year. The rest of the time, they're kind of working their way around the world. So it's quite an operation even just to keep them going.
What sort of facilities do you have on the yachts?
Well, everything really. Obviously, they're designed, you know, people went the full way around the world on them. So they're actually very spacious inside, with kind of headroom of about 8 foot, which is very unusual for a cruising yacht, and kind of big accommodation areas. There's a large galley where people can cook and make their meals, and an accompanying saloon on it. It's actually very warm and it's comfortable and it's very safe, but it's kind of, would you describe it as industrial? Maybe not quite, but it's fit for purpose. You know, it's designed to go to the polar regions and to Iceland and to cross oceans and all the rest of that. You're in your own little kind of world once you're on these yachts, completely self-contained, self-sufficient. You can make your own electricity, you can make your own water, and just kind of head off to wherever you want to go in the world.
So if I want to come on one of your holidays, do I have to be a really experienced sailor?
No, not at all. So the whole ethos of Rubicon 3 is helping non-sailors experience adventures at sea. When I was growing up, I was kind of transfixed by the books of the Famous Five and Swallows and Amazons. And fun enough, kind of on your question, the one that really always, even to this day, stays with me kind of 40 years on, is, I can't quite remember the name of it, but we didn't mean to go to sea. The children accidentally sail off across the North Sea and have this most wonderful adventure. And to this day, I still kind of think of that when we get new people joining, and very often not really knowing what they're going to expect. Because as much as we might describe it to them in advance, it's only really once you've gone out onto the open sea that you really understand it. And we teach them everything they need to know, from the very basic nautical terms so they can work their way around the boat, to the kind of principles of sailing and how to get out there and to make the boat move. What makes it unusual is that as a non-sailor, you can become a fully participating member of an adventure going off to places that most even experienced sailors can't get to.
Our main sailing experience has been a week on a flotilla, where we had a few lessons before, and then we were just let loose with our children
in Greece,
around the Greek islands, without any sort of sat-nav, and we had no idea really what we were doing.
It was terrifying, frankly.
We hadn't really been taught enough, and there was no one with us. I mean, with yours, there'll be someone with you.
Is oh, that yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we have a highly experienced skipper who would have done, you know, the best part of 100,000 miles and been at sea for 10 or 15 years. Most of them have kind of circumnavigated. And they also have a professional mate with them as well, who's also a professional sailor, but, you know, kind of building their skills and experience as they go, but will also have been working professionally usually for 3 or 4 years. It's a very interesting one, heading out to sea without having been trained. It's a bit like when you go out into the mountains or something. It's fine whilst it's good, but, you know, the sea is a powerful entity. I think people forget and become complacent about the power of that force and what can be done to it. So I have my own views on sending people out to sea with 5 days training, but we're probably at the very opposite end of the scale of that super high class training and support and safety and stuff.
Well, that sounds good. So how did this all come about? You've always been a sailor since you were a child?
No. So I think the only word for it is forced to sail. I was sent off to Datchet Reservoir by Heathrow Airport and put into these kind of awful flat-fronted boats called mirrors, and miserably worked my way up and down this reservoir, regularly falling in, because I would never describe myself as a natural sailor at all. And then in my early teens, I was sent off up to Scotland, to the north of Scotland, to a boarding school up there, and was again forced to sail. And it's bitterly cold up there. We were wearing these, we had to wear these kind of sailing uniforms, which must have been designed and built in the kind of 1950s or 60s or something, all kind of scratchy and smelly and horrible. And if anything is designed to put you off sailing, you know, when you're new to it, it's one, sailing in the cold and the wet, and secondly, being made to wear silly costumes and stuff, you know. So, and then over the years, you know, I did my sailing qualifications and I'd sail for leisure and fun, but nothing really more than that. And then in my kind of late 20s, early 30s, I did the very unoriginal running away from everything sensible, from the mortgage and the long-term relationship and the very successful and I have to say well-paid job.
What was your job?
So I used to work in newspapers. I did various things growing up. So I always had a fairly rebellious and independent streak, I would say, and tried various of my own businesses in my late teens and early 20s, ranging from the South London secondhand tire market through to I opened a bar, which I think most people in their early 20s have thought, oh, we could get together and we could run a fantastic bar. And then, of course, as with so many things, you know, reality kicks in. I know so many people in my type of world who've tried similar things. And I think it's that desire to be the master of your own destiny, to be able to make your own way and to be shaping your own destiny rather than just following and taking instructions. And no skippers I know are very good at taking instructions, I have to say. I know that now because I try to give them instructions sober. I come from the other side of things now. But then I kind of found myself heading off across Russia and Kazakhstan, went across Siberia and Mongolia overland. So it was a fantastic way to do it without any real kind of detailed planned itinerary. I just needed to really get away. I'd never traveled much before that. I'd kind of been working since I was 17, 18, really, one way and another. I just really needed to experience something different, to push myself in different ways, to find a different way of doing things, a different way to interact with myself and with other people, really. And so I headed off to the most remote parts that I could imagine, really. And it was fantastic. It's the same as when you head far out to sea. It allows you to reset and rebuild and kind of restructure yourself in so many ways, because there are none of the societal structures and supports that we get so used to having around us, and none of the influences or constraints that we're faced by having, you know, societal norms, how we must act and when we have to go to work and how we have to dress and all the rest of it. Once you're out in the wilds, whether it's on land or at sea, it's all gone. You have to rebuild your relationship with yourself in many ways. A lot of our crews will find this too. And that's really what happened to me. The trouble is, what I didn't find was any more money coming in. So eventually I did what so many people have done and ran off to sea without a plan. Again, there was no intent to go and work on the sea, but that was the path that opened up for me.
So on that first big adventure, you just went by yourself or did you go on an expedition? How did you do this?
No, I went with an overland company. And so there were, I think it was the only time they ever ran this route because it proved too extreme. But we went from St. Petersburg in Russia right across the continent there over this course of, I think it was 4 months, 3 to 4 months. But every day, I mean, you are so far removed from any sort of tourist or even often kind of societal habitations. You're right out in the desert, in the wilds. You regularly kind of sink into sticky bogs and mud, and you dig your way out and put tank tracks under the wheels and force your way through and stuff. So then you're kind of just finding firewood in the evenings to make a fire and cook your food on and so on. Once I got to Beijing in China, I then struck off solo, going down through the inner lands of Vietnam and across India and so on, until eventually I arrived in South Africa. Well, you can't really go much further south without getting on a boat. So that's pretty much what I did. I got on a boat.
But yeah. On this trip, did anything go wrong?
Do you know, it's an interesting phrase, does it go wrong? We kind of discuss this on the boats a lot as well, that the whole purpose of heading off on this type of trip is actually, is it not, to face challenges and to experience things that take you out of your comfort zone. So we would have minor things. I've already described how we would gradually sink into a bog and have to dig our way out, which is all great when you're covered in mud, except that there's no chance of a wash or a shower for maybe, you know, the next 2 weeks or so. So you become quite a bizarre looking creature, and quite stinky too, I have to say. But I think one of the incidents that has always really struck me is we arrived at this town called Aral. And I don't know, you may have heard of the Aral Sea, right in the middle of Kazakhstan. And it's this extraordinary place where, if you can imagine taking a fishing port from the south coast of England, you know, something like Falmouth, and just removing all the sea and turning it into the middle of a desert, this is what Aral is. And the Russians over there, you know, during the times of the Soviet Union, had diverted all the water to irrigate their fields and their crops. And it reaches a catastrophic point of no return. And the Aral Sea just died and became this desert. And, you know, you head kind of 6-7 miles out from this harbor that's sitting in the sand, and you arrive, or you did arrive then, it's all gone now, at these huge cargo ships and fishing boats that just sat out there in the desert. So it's a very extraordinary place, but the population are still there. And of course, have received no support or no help at all. And so when we arrived there, it was quickly turned into a very hostile, very aggressive environment. There's a huge alcohol problem there and desperate poverty. And it's one of those real clashes where we don't really have a purpose to be there except for our own self-fulfillment or kind of tourism or whatever it is. And these people are seeing a source of money and a sense of self-awareness to be seen in the state that they were, really. It was a pretty hairy escape, really, you know, where we were locked ourselves in the vehicle. And there were people jumping on the vehicle and we're trying to drive off, and quite extraordinary, really.
Yeah, it sounds a pretty bizarre experience. So having got South Africa, then you've got yourself on a boat. You end up in the States?
No. So there I actually just was sailing, and I was chatting to the skipper and explained that I was basically out of money. And did he have any thoughts of how I could make some money? And he was like, you could skipper this boat. He says, because I'm leaving and we need someone to take over. So in short order, I did that and started actually teaching other people to sail. And we would work our way right around the Horn of Africa and up the east coast of Africa. And I worked there for about a year. And then gradually, in that very unplanned way, became a full-time professional sailor, and found really then what I guess I'd been looking for many years, which was the relationship I have with the sea is something that fulfills something in me that I guess I've always been searching for. That kind of solitude and that just the space and the time and the honesty. It's an incredibly honest environment being out at sea. There's no hiding. There's no cause or value from explaining why something's gone wrong. It's either worked or it hasn't, and you either are succeeding or you're not. And I very quickly found that it's where I love to be. And so I worked out there for a while, and then I worked around various countries in Europe, all the various jobs that you can do as a professional sailor, from deliveries to charter work and all the rest of it.
And one of the private yachts you worked on belonged to a US diplomat at the Vatican.
Yeah, so a bit further down the line. So having worked as a sailor for many years, I then realised that I couldn't fix the boats, not nearly well enough. And so I headed off to the US to spend a year training in marine systems, so that as well as actually sailing the boats, I could properly maintain and repair them. And after doing that course, I then got the job as engineer on a large sailing superyacht, which was owned by the US ambassador to the Vatican. It was his private yacht, and we would help him entertain himself and his guests as he sailed around various nice parts of the world. And kind of what an insight into a different life that is. It's quite something.
And then you met your wife along the line here.
Yeah, just before I went to sea on that boat, we met in the States. And 12 weeks later, I woke her up at 6 a.m. just before heading to sea for the first time on this boat. And as you know, it's such a corny situation, isn't it? But I knew that, as far as I knew, I was about to go to sea for 7-8 months without seeing her again. So I thought, you know, I need to ask this lovely lady to marry me. So I woke her up, and it was all ridiculous. But she stunned and said yes. And I, you know, I had my flight to catch 40 minutes later. So I jumped on the plane and flew down to the boat. And I'd asked her to marry me in Newport in Rhode Island. And I got down to the boat, and the captain said, "So there's been a change of plan, and we're going to turn around and sail to Newport, Rhode Island." And so having done this huge kind of romantic, you know, "Will you marry me? I'm off to sea." About 2 weeks later, there I was back, right back with her. Yeah, best laid plans and all the rest of it.
I bet she was pleased.
I think we were both stunned, really. You have to almost start again, but it's 10 years ago now, and we're still very happily married. So something went well.
And that was the same year as you were caught in a hurricane.
That's right. So that part of the States is quite regularly hit by hurricanes. You know, they come up, they work their way up through the Bahamas and through the southern states and then up the eastern seaboard. And that year I was on watch when Hurricane Sandy, it was, came through. Being told you have to be on a yacht at sea to face a hurricane is a pretty nerve-wracking experience. You know, you don't really know what to expect. It's easy to overthink it because, you know, you're still close to shore, you know, so the actual sea state itself, you're not expecting to be huge, but the force of the winds is so huge that if anything does start to go wrong, you have really no chance of sorting things out at all. But as professional sailors, you know, when you're told you need to be on there, you need to be on there. So I was sitting there and keeping watch, and the winds of, you know, kind of 60-70 miles an hour, and it was fairly terrifying. In the middle of it, completely randomly, at about 3 a.m., I guess, our time, or 4 a.m., I got a call from this very kind of British voice saying, "Hi, it's the BBC here, and we've heard that you're on this yacht. Would you do an interview with us?" And it was completely surreal to be suddenly talking to the BBC. And before you know it, you know, you say yes, and they say, "Right, hold fire, please." And I literally, 10 seconds later, you hear the beeps and the you know, the guy introducing the fact that now we have Bruce Jacobs, and suddenly you're live on TV and receiving text messages from your friends, you know, saying, "What on earth are you doing live on TV in a hurricane?"
What happened to the boat in the hurricane? Does it sort of
ride the
what
waves?
Does it do? Yeah, it rides the waves.
Yeah. And that's the job of the crew, is to keep it positioned in a certain way so that, you know, you obviously take it into a very sheltered place. So the thing that boats don't like is the massive sea state more than anything. And it's the distance that wind blows over the water that produces the sea state. So you position a boat like that, I think you're about 100 meters offshore. So the sea state itself just doesn't have time to build up into anything, you know, and this is a large boat, but the force of the wind is extraordinary. Things, you know, are either close to ripping off, and you can see other boats on shore where they've come loose from their moorings, smashing into the shore and stuff. It's a very extraordinary thing to be in wind at that strength.
So bringing us back to your present venture with sailing holidays, where do you go on these sailing holidays?
Really, once a year, we sit down and we bring out a big chart and we look at areas that give us that sense of excitement. And we pick that and we say, right, you know, these are the places we need to go this year. The aim is very much to enable people to sail to areas where you can't go to on a flotilla or on sunsail or wherever, you know, those types of boats, which are wonderful in themselves, but they just can't go. There are so many places of the world that are not accessible to commercial sailing, partly because of the rules and regulations surrounding the yachts and what's required for them to get there and the number of crew, but also just the type of yacht that you require. You have to have an incredibly seaworthy yacht. So we do a lot of expeditions up in the high latitudes. We'll spend a lot of our summer up in, you know, above the Arctic Circle in Norway, going right up to Svalbard, right up to the edge of the pack ice, an incredible world of polar bears and glaciers and icebergs and stuff. And we spend quite a lot of time in Iceland, which is very rugged and very wild, the Faroe Islands. And then next year, we're back to Greenland again, which is a truly extraordinary place. And then in the winter months, we head across the Atlantic and we will go to the kind of further reaches of the Caribbean, to places like Belize and Honduras, up to New York, and then up to Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, so many places, but with the aim of each place being it has to be somewhere wild and unusual and fascinating. And a large part of our experience is to enable people to go ashore.
How many people do you take on each yacht?
So on each yacht, we have 9 people, 1 skipper and 1 mate. So it's very much a teaching environment as well. There are no passengers. So everybody who comes on board will be navigating, planning, cooking, trimming sails. It's a very immersive adventure.
So if someone turns up, maybe a couple, and then one person in that couple decides they hate sailing, or what happens then? Can they just be the cook?
Of course. Look, it's an incredibly gentle and supportive environment on board. So one of the things I was absolutely clear on when we set this up was that I did not want this to be a male aggressive, domineering environment. It really needs to be very gentle and very supportive to enable everyone to join in. Our average customer age is actually 50 years old, and more than half of our customers are females. And for the sailing industry, that's unheard of.
Mostly solo?
Yeah. So I think to answer the question before, I think couples have generally worked out beforehand whether they might want to come sailing or not. And one will be fascinated and kind of addicted to the idea, and the other one will be truly horrified by the prospect and would no more come on one of our yachts than anything else. And that exactly equates to myself and my wife. She would be horrified to have to ever come anywhere near what we do. She likes a big, large, luxury motor yacht, and not that she ever gets a chance to go on it, but whereas I love the wild and the adventure and the things that happen out at sea.
And those 9 people won't have met before. Everyone gets on okay?
Yeah, they do. I think anyone who signs up to these things is so brave, because not only are you giving up your, literally, legally, your authority to a skipper and mate who you don't know, you've got all the kind of physical questions, how tough is it going to be? How hard is it going to be? But also you are committing to living in quite close quarters with 8 or 9, 10 other people who you've never met before for 2 weeks. And it's not like, especially if you're on an ocean passage, it's not like you can just decide, I'm going to get off, this is not for me. So it's quite something to do. But what we find is actually the opposite of what people are scared of or worried about. And that's they form these extraordinary friendships, these really strong bonds amongst so many of the crew. And I think because, one, they're quite a homogenous group of people. So because the average age is kind of from about 45 to 65, a lot of people are in the same life stage anyway. And the motivations that have brought them to suddenly find themselves on a yacht in Svalbard or somewhere are, that narrows you down to a certain type of person anyway. One of the things we always notice is when you're at work, for instance, you could spend 2-3 weeks with someone new to the team and you might just about know their name. You might have said hello, whatever. This is like a super fast track, accelerated get to know you process, where in the course of 12 days, you would have seen that person laugh, possibly cry, being as tired as they can be as excited as they can be. And you just get to know someone so well and in such an honest and unpolished environment or way. And the friendships are extraordinary that are built up.
So do they sometimes go beyond friendships? Do you actually get relationships built?
We have had a marriage on board. Well, the marriage itself wasn't on board, but they did later marry. And yes, there are numerous couples now who have come together as a result of their Rubicon 3. And we love that. It's amazing. I'd like to say we have the whole Rubicon 3 community anyway, but gradually you're seeing kind of, young families form and all the rest of it. So it's very special for us.
Great holiday for singles then.
It is in many ways. It is a fantastic holiday for singles. But, on a different way as well, it's quite interesting because traveling solo for many people is quite hard. There can be a bit of a stigma attached to it, and there can be lots of extra costs attached to it. And what makes these types of adventures so special is, one, that everyone comes solo, but secondly, you're working as part of a team. So all those things that can make solo travel difficult are just removed, and not in a manufactured way, through pure necessity. And I think that's what makes it so attractive to people traveling solo as well.
No single room supplements.
There is only a single room. Everybody sleeps in one large accommodation area.
Oh, I see. Okay, like a dormitory.
Exactly. So I do often describe it as like adult boarding school, on the first day, everyone's very polite. No one would ever think to take the last beer or the last whatever. And then you start to hear kind of laughter during the night. And, you know, then in the morning, everyone's laughing and joking and there's games being played on each other. And it's it very quickly becomes a very fun and just very unusual environment for adults. How often or when do you find yourself sleeping in a large dormitory with other people out at sea in a different part of the world?
So this takes me back to Gordonstoun, your original schooling in Scotland, which of course is where King Charles went to school.
That's right.
Much older yes. than you, but he went there and he hated it. Did you like it or hate it?
I think mixed views. I'd love to go there now. I think older, you know, they always say that school's wasted on the young, don't they? To have the chance of all those opportunities, you know, out in the mountains and diving and sailing and all sorts of things would be amazing. I think it was a tough environment to be in. A very different, I know for a fact it's very different then to how it is now. Back in my day, it was the last of the kind of the old money families who were there. So everyone in my year, not everyone, but a large number had were lord this or baron this or what. I mean, you look back at it now and it's so extraordinary. It's just kind of bizarre, really. And they'd all been at boarding school since they were like 7 or 8 years old. Had largely been like kind of sent there and left there by their parents. So it was quite an extraordinary collection and quite a subculture. And, you know, you could easily say they'd kind of designed Lord of the Flies from having been to the, you know, the school then and designed it and stuff. But also amazing friendships. And I recently met someone from my year there who I haven't seen in 35 years. And it's like we'd never stopped meeting, really. You build some very, very strong relationships at a school like that. For some, it's a great place.
Not for King Charles, I don't think.
No, I don't think he liked it so much. But what a burden to carry with you as a young guy growing up. Life's hard enough, isn't it? I think growing up without having to deal with all of that as well. Good luck to him.
That was the past. What about the future? How do you see your business going? Will you expand or stay the same?
Well, so one of the things which great frustration, we were just about to get going before COVID, is I'm very focused now on expanding this to younger disadvantaged people. It was always part of our DNA that we were going to do that. And when we first started, we used to run scholarships for young adults whose lives hadn't quite panned out how they expected, and to give them a new chance and a new experience. And for various reasons, it kind of didn't prove to be quite the right fit and mix there. But we had just signed up with one of the inner London schools, a very famous one called the Michaela School, run by a lady called Catherine Birbal Singh, who's a very kind of prominent educationalist. It's based in Wembley in North London, and she takes these inner city children from really the most deprived regions and puts them through this environment of really, you know, let's be honest, quite high discipline, but exceptional high expectations and standards. A large number of them go to Oxford and Cambridge, and it's this kind of wonderful, I find inspiring and fantastic place. And so we had just kind of got this whole program in place where we're going to start taking them out to sea and gradually build up to taking them to Norway and Iceland. And then COVID hit and just smashed it. I mean, just destroyed everything. But so we are just now starting to get back. Our next big thing is to start opening this up to people who would never have a chance to do something like this.
Can families come?
Yeah, we do quite a few family charters. So what we'll often find is, because our boats take 9 people, we often get 2 families coming together. And it becomes, again, this kind of, you know, I've touched on it before, this wonderful swallows and Amazons environment. So you'll have kind of 4 adults, and it's brilliant for them. One, because they're sailing off somewhere very exciting and fun, and they've got their own, you know, themselves for the more kind of adult company. But then this kind of pack of children. We do the family charters in the much more kind of relaxed areas. So there's a place up in Norway called the Lofoten Islands, which you can only really say if Disney kind of made a sailing ground, this is what it would look like. It's stunningly beautiful, really easy sailing, but loads of kayaking and fishing and hiking up hills. And the pack of kids will just kind of charge off, and we'll help them kind of learn their trade, their craft skills and all the rest of it. And it's spectacular. I love doing the family trip. To see children especially having their eyes open and this kind of magical world presented to them, there's such an innocence to it and such a joy in it. I think adventure as a term is used very easily these days. You know, you talk about an adventure holiday, but actually for most adventure holidays out there, you might be being driven around on a safari or something. And what is the element of adventure? It has to have that level of uncertainty, that level of risk to an extent, to make it a true adventure, a true challenge. And our customers will join us. Everyone's definition of what's adventurous for them will obviously vary. And there is unquestionably an element of tiredness, fear, all the things that you don't necessarily highlight. You know, it's not that you hide it, but things that people are willing to risk and to take on and will find themselves experiencing out there. And I think for us, for me, one of the most fulfilling parts of this business, of this thing that we do, is seeing people who often join us really quite shy, quite reserved, maybe really having lost confidence in themselves, especially if they've spent years bringing up children or whatever it is. Their natural abilities and skills maybe haven't had the light of day for many years, other than what they've had to do for their career or as a parent. And seeing them 2, 3, 4 days later, helming a round the world race boat at night under the stars with big sails up, or hauling themselves to the front and showing really true courage and fortitude to haul down sails as a kind of a storm blows over. It's a very, very special part for me. That human element and seeing people develop is, yeah, what makes it unique for us.
If people want to find out more, how do they get in touch with you?
Yeah, so we have our website, which is called rubicon3adventure.com, and that's with a number 3. And they can obviously then through there, they can email us or they can call us. We're there pretty much 24 hours a day because the boats are operating 24 hours a day. And we're always very willing just to have a chat with people. This is something very unusual. It's not something that you would have likely done much of before. So we always encourage people just to call up and just start talking. Start telling us what types of things excite you or what your fears are. And we chat away for often about 20 minutes and find something that just really is going to work for them.
Bruce Jacobs, thanks very much indeed for coming on the show, and we look forward to hearing more of your adventures in the future.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, guys.
That's all for now. If you've enjoyed the show, please visit our website, actionpacktravel.com, or you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, or any of the many podcast platforms. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'd love you to sign up for our regular emails too at peter@actionpacktravel.com. Until next week, stay safe.
And I am you.
And you are me.
It's just a crazy storm.